Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are. Shalom Aleichem, Assalamu Aleichem, Namaste, Pak Sat Nam, Sat Sri Akal, Tashi Dalek, Ho Lila Tanyan Wasi Yake. Let me adjust our recording levels here, just real quickly. And I think that's going to be better. Yeah, that looks, that's a little high. Let's turn that down a little bit right here. Okay, there we go. All right. And, of course, we're going to continue on teaching today, this beautiful afternoon, sunny afternoon day, Monday, at least here, sunny here in the Pacific Northwest, in the city of Issaquah, just about 20 miles to the east of Seattle. And I hope it's a sunny day wherever you are. But before we begin teaching, I will do as I do every day at the beginning of a shir, and I will recite the Kaddish for the dead and the mourners of the dead. So please close your eyes as you listen and remember someone to whom you are close who has passed away. In doing so, you will honor that person's life and bless his or her memory with the light of your own consciousness. Yiskadov Yishkadash Merabo Bomo Dive Ro Kerase Vayamlik Malkase Vakayakon Uvio Makon Uvkaya dekol beis Yisrael, ba'agalo uviz man korya vayimru omein. Yehesh me rabo mavorak leolam, ule ome omayo. Yisparak v'yistavak v'yisparar v'yisromam, v'yisnase v'yishadar v'yisale v'yishalal. Shmedu kadsho beriku le'elo, minkol berkaso v'shiroso, tush bekoso v'nekamoso, da'amirom be'omo vayimru omein. Yehe Shlomo Rabo Min Shemayo Vekayim Olenu Ve'el Kol Yisrael Ve'imru Omein. Ose Shalom Bimrabo Huyashe Shalom Olenu Ve'el Kol Yisrael Ve'imru Omein. Thank you very much. It's fitting that that we're teaching right now on, and have been for the past several weeks, on Devakut, which is the Jewish mysticism version, the version in Jewish mysticism of Unio Mystica, which is just a Latin phrase that's generic and applies to mysticism in all religious containers, to that condition, as I said, titled in Latin Unio Mystica, which means mystical union. Mystical union of what? Mystical union of the mystic or some aspect of the mystic, either the mystic's intellect or soul, with some aspect of the divine, either one of the divine's ministering angels or one of the divine well, I'm not going to say Gnosticism, but because that's more or less a dead religious container. But in terms of, let's say, in terms of Judaism, mystical Judaism, Kabbalah specifically, union between the mystic and one of God's 10 holy sephirot, which are, are named and have specific names of God assigned to them, and thus are containers of aspects of God's personality, divine personality, and are, as I've taught before, actually manifestations of God in a descending order, descending from Ein Sof, which is totally transcendent and completely spiritual, completely ethereal, and thus unknowable in any manner by the human mind or the human soul, totally unreachable, unfathomable, Ein Sof meaning without end, meaning the eternal, a descent from that state of being into the world which Ein Sof had created through its will, and through its voice, had created the various worlds of the Sephirot, of the ten Sephirot, the four worlds of the ten Sephirot, and actually a fifth world above called Adam Kadmon. And so it descended from a state of total transcendence and ethereality and spirituality into these lower five worlds, and in doing so, lost a little bit more of that ethereality or spirituality and took on a few more of the aspects of materiality and temporality, physicality. Okay, as God comes into the world of the phenomenal world of forms and names in which we live, in which our universe exists, in which there are such things composed of matter in relationship with each other through the medium of space and existing in time. As God came into that through this hierarchy of worlds, coming down from Adam Kadmon into the world of the Sefirot, into the world of Atzilut, the world of nearness and emanation, and from there into the world of Berea, the world of creation, or the throne world, as the Merkabah mystics looked at it, the world of the throne which was seen by Ezekiel in his great vision, the throne upon which the Holy One, blessed be He, was seated. And from the world of Berea, the world of creation, the throne world, God manifested itself at the next lower level, the world of Yetzirah, the world of formation. This is the angelic world, the world of the ministering angels, in which the forces are transmitted through the laws of the universe, and by which the planets are formed and the stars are formed and condensed out of the galactical swirling of gases, and the galaxies are made and etc. And they all revolve around each other. And the universe expands through time, and time itself expands and dilates, becoming slower and slower from the universal perspective. Okay, that's the world of Yetzirah, the world of formation, and the world of in the Merkabah point of view, this would be the angelic world, the world where God's ministering angels are. Okay, and then even below that, the next world, which in this hierarchy would be the fifth world, would be the world of Asiya, the world of action, the world in which all the world of what I call the world of forms and names. And so God comes down and becomes less ethereal, less spiritual, more less omniscient, and less integrated, and becomes more scattered, more into physicality. God becomes scattered in pieces in every single physical piece of physical matter in the world, and God's energy is scattered in energy, which, of course, as we know, matter is just gravitationally trapped energy. And so God is in all of these things. God is in all of these things. In truly, God is kol. El kol. God is all. And all, and God is in all. And all is in God. But not everything is God. It's just a semantic paradox. Don't worry about it. But in any event, that's what God does. He comes down and becomes more physical, more manifests himself so that we may know God, and so that God may know us, so that God may come into relationship with us, into communion with us, and we with God. And that's what Devakut is in Jewish mysticism in Kabbalah. That's what Devakut is, clinging, cleaving to God, pursuing close after. That's what the mystic does. And that's what we've been talking about. And so I say it's fitting that I begin this teaching today by saying, as the as preparation, as the mental preparation and emotional preparation for reciting the Kaddish for the Dead and the Mourners of the Dead, when I say please close your eyes as you listen and remember someone to whom you were close who has passed away. Because in doing so, you'll honor that person's life and bless his or her memory with what? With the light of your own consciousness. So why is that fitting? What am I getting at here? Well, what I'm saying is close your eyes as you listen and remember. Okay, when you remember, what do you do when you remember someone to whom you were close who has passed away? You call into the consciousness of your forebrain, of your frontal lobes, you call into that area of your brain where your consciousness is collected, your being consciousness is collected at that point, actually your ego consciousness, not your being consciousness, but your ego consciousness is collected there in the frontal lobes of your brain, your physical brain, and your focus, the focus of your attention is there in that place, and when you remember, you visualize that person in your mind's eye. That's what a memory is. And you remember their look, the sound of them, perhaps the smell of a loved one's hair, or the particular, peculiar smell of that person wearing a certain perfume, certain events that you shared, activities, things that they said, things that you did. All those things can come into your mind when you remember a person. And when you do this, that person's life is then no longer out of your consciousness in the darkness. It's in the light of your consciousness. That person's life and relationship with you is now illuminated. And when you do that, you then know that person, and that person being known becomes real again, becomes real, and at that moment is living. Yes, albeit confined in your consciousness, but it doesn't make any difference to that person. It makes a big difference to you because that person is living in your memory at that moment in time. And that's a blessing. It's an honor to that person's life and to your relationship with that person, and it's a blessing for that person and that person's memory. All right. Now then, in our last meeting, or our last two meetings, I'm going to just summarize real quickly here and shortly what we talked about in our last two meetings. I said that according to Moshe Idel, the great Jewish scholar of Kabbalah, there are three basic types of devakut in Jewish mysticism. And he doesn't mean with respect to the experience, he means with respect to the descriptive terminology as to what type of philosophical container one would naturally sort the terminology associated with these three types of unio mystica, or mystical union of the mystic with the divine mind or the divine Godhead. And those are Aristotelian, Neoplatonic, and Hermetic, named for three different categories of philosophy. And there are many categories of philosophy, but these three happen to be Aristotelian, which has to do with the unification of the human intellect with respect to unio mystica, okay? Aristotelian unio mystica, or devakut, has to do with unification of the human intellect with the divine intellect. It's a mind-to-mind unification. Human intellect, divine intellect. Human mind, divine mind. Neoplatonic is the second form of devakut. This is unification of the human soul with its root, the divine soul, from which all souls are derived, from Malkut, Okay. The third category is hermetic. This is in reference to medieval times, the use of alchemy in the search for the philosopher's stone, which really was a form of human spiritual, psycho-spiritual perfection, not really for gold. The gold was being sought as a metaphor for the perfection of the human soul or being. Okay, and that type of Devakut, under that type of terminology, makes use of descent magic, as in descending, descent magic, to draw down Rahaniot, spiritual beings. So the mystic uses incantations, formulations, special concentration and meditation and chanting on various divine letters and names in magic, in a magical process that is designed to draw down these spiritual beings, with which the mystic then experiences mystical union and learns certain things, certain mystical esoteric knowledge is passed on to the mystic from its possessor, with whom the mystic has united. Okay, then we looked at a little bit more in depth the Aristotelian form of Devakut, and remember that's the form in which unification of the human intellect takes place with the divine intellect. And we talked about it from the Jungian perspective of when a knowing subject, that's you or me, the mystic, brings into our consciousness, and here's this relationship to the beginning of our classes when I talk about bringing the memory of a departed loved one into our consciousness. Okay, that's what this is about here. When a knowing subject, you or me, brings into his or her consciousness a known object, and the knower, you or me, and that which is known, which can be anything, can be a tree, it can be a chimpanzee in the forest of Africa, it can be a god or an angel of God, become one. It's the act of knowing that creates the union of the two, the knowing subject and the known object. And then I read to you Edward Edinger, who was one of the great gifted pupils of Carl Gustav Jung, what he wrote in his book called The Meaning of Consciousness. He said, the experience of being the known subject, however, is only one half of the process of knowledge. The other half is the experience of being the known object. The ego, that's our ego he's talking about here now, okay? The ego as knower conquers the outer or inner other by relegating it to the status of known object. And what does he say conquers the outer or inner other? And he has other in quotes. Well, other is just meant to distinguish the known object from the knowing subject. It's like that's the nature of the ego. The ego regards only itself as self. Everything that's not self is other. Okay, and I'm referring now to kind of like set theory, okay? It's philosophical or metaphysical, but it still has to do with set theory. There is the ego. You can draw a circle and label it ego, consciousness, that's in our minds. And then another circle that completely surrounds the ego consciousness, and then label that circle as other. And then you can start making little circles inside that other circle called other. You can say, here's a circle and this is all trees. You can start subdividing all of these into an infinite number of others, but they are all others. Okay? And so what he says here is that the ego, as knower, conquers the outer or inner other. Now what does that mean? Outer or inner other. outer or inner other? Well, an outer other would be all others that exist outside of our being consciousness. I'm using some terms here that you probably have never heard before, unless you have studied Gurdjieff or Uspensky. Okay, or some other, possibly some other modern, some other depth psychologists. Okay, our being consciousness is what we refer to, what the ego means when it says I. It doesn't mean just the psychological concept of I-ness. It means I, which is a physical body containing a brain, which itself contains three centers, the emotional, the moving, and the thinking center. Actually, four centers, and the feeling center. These are the four functions that Jung teaches about. Okay, so I, when the ego says I, it doesn't just mean the ego consciousness. It means all, the entire being consciousness. And that's the body, the brain, and all four of its functions. And there's three parts. And the soul. Yes, the soul. The ego doesn't like to think about that. The ego has to be trained to think about the soul. Because the ego wants to deny the existence of the soul. Why does the ego want to deny the existence of the soul? Because the ego has been split off from the soul. At the moment of birth, God binds a divine soul to a physical human body. And at that very instant, when that occurs, a piece of the divine soul is split off and becomes associated totally with the physical body. This is the ego consciousness. The soul can be described as the self with a capital S. Okay? The soul can be described as the self with a capital S, whereas that little piece of it that was split off, born from, if you will, born from the divine soul at the moment of the birth of the physical body, that birth of that little piece, that junior piece of the divine soul, is described as the ego consciousness. And it becomes indelibly affixed to the physical body. Why is this necessary? Because that piece is a part of, remember I talked about in our last meeting, I believe I talked about the fact that there's two souls in each human being. There's an animal soul, and the name of that soul is the nephesh. And there's a divine soul, and that soul consists of five parts, which I'm not going to name them off, but which there are five parts, of which the least sophisticated or lowest level of which is the nephesh. So if there's a divine soul in the human body and the bottom level of it, the grossest part of which, the lowest evolved part of which is called the nephesh, and then the other soul, which is the animal soul, which is also the ego consciousness, has been split off from it, and it's called the nephesh, so you can see what part has been split off from what. The ego consciousness is the animal soul, which has been split off from the divine. It's the human part of the animal soul, which has been split off from or born out of the nephesh part of the five-layered divine soul. Okay? And the human body must have this. If the human body doesn't have it, it doesn't live. Because every living thing in the universe has, at a minimum, to be counted as a living thing. It has a nephesh. It has an animal soul. Plants have them. Plants have them. Animals have them. Of all kinds, of all levels of being. Even if it's a one-celled animal, it has them. Bacteria, if they're considered to be animals, they have a nephesh. they have an animal soul. Highly different from the divine soul that man has, which was blown into him through his nostrils by the Ruach HaKodesh. And what is the second level of soul in the divine soul? The Ruach, the wind of God's breath. As an aside here, I'm reminded of a poem by Rafiz. I believe is his name. He's the most beloved of all Iranian poets. He lived around the year 1350 in the Common Era. And I have adapted it. It's only two lines, so don't worry. I've adapted it from not from the Farsi, believe me. I could never read or would want to try to learn how to read or write Farsi. But from that's already been done for me, and I've acquired some of his books of poetry, which are all, by the way, works of theology as much as poetry and spiritualism. And what I mean by that is on the path of the spirit, of the ascent of the spirit toward God in the process of cleaving, devakut. But his religion, of course, was Sufism in Islam. And so his metaphors are a little bit different. So I've adapted this poem kind of to the Kabbalistic view. And here's the poem. I'm going completely by memory. I didn't write this down. But it will give you an idea of what I'm saying about the soul, the human soul, and about part of it being the breath of God. He says, Hafiz says, I am a hole in the flute through which the breath of God flows. Listen to me sing, or listen to my music. I am a hole in the flute through which the breath of God flows. Listen to my music. Ah, the man was such a stupendous poet. Just poem after poem after poem has that type of beauty, and it's all about the relationship between man and God. I'll try to get it. I'm trying to get a list of books on our website. It's kind of an aside, so just go with me on this. I'll return in a moment to the teaching, but I'm trying to get on our website a list of books that I recommend that you can purchase easily from various sources, most of which from Amazon.com. But which will help you in your studies of Kabbalah and of Jewish mysticism and mysticism in general, and of course a couple of these books will be these poems by Hafiz, and another one by Rumi, earlier Iranian or at that time Persian poet. So anyway, that's what the soul does. The soul, you've got two souls in you. You've got an animal soul, which is the ego consciousness, without which the human body would not live. It would just be a collection of dead chemical molecules. They would not be animated. And when we say animal soul, what we do not mean by animal soul is that it's the same, that it's that you have the soul of an animal, you have a soul of a turtle, the soul of a turtle dove, the soul of a dog or a cat. That's not what we're talking about. It's not what we mean by saying that you have an animal soul. What we mean is its root meaning from the Latin word animus. Animus. Okay? And what that means is moving. It means as in vivified. Having a motive force, being alive. Okay, so all things that are living are animated by a mysterious force that flows through the universe. But that force will not animate any object unless it has within it an animal soul, a nefesh. It has to have a receiving organ. An organ to receive the holy shafa of God. That's the animating force that goes through the universe. It's God's divine sustenance, the animating force. But you don't see rocks moving around. You know, see them changing their locations to get more comfortable. They're where they are. You don't see dirt digging itself up, rearranging itself. No, you only see this, we call these inanimate objects because they do not have an animus in them, meaning they do not have a force that allows them to be living, that brings them to life. They do not have that receiving, that receptor organ. And that organ, I'm telling you, is the nephesh, the animating soul, the animal soul. Okay? You have one, I have them. Every animal has one, and all plants have one. Everything living, algae has it. Okay? And that's what makes it an animate object as opposed to an inanimate object. But what distinguishes the human from all other animate objects is that the human has a divine soul as well. And that divine soul has these five levels or aspects to which one can rise up. Everybody has the ruach. Every human being has, first of all, the animating receptor organ called the nephesh, the animal soul. But beyond this, what makes you human is you have, at least to start with, the ruach, the breath, the wind. Okay, this is the level that makes you human, makes you a human being. This is what provides you the necessary means, let me just put a different aspect. It's what provides the human being with the means to evolve upward. The means to achieve perfection, to improve one's position in the world, to improve one's level of consciousness and existence, one's level of spirituality. That capability is inherent in the ruach, in the second level of the divine soul. And if one works, and only if one works, unless, of course, God, out of pure grace, determines otherwise, God can make anything happen. Okay? He can say, okay, you're now going to become an angel, or you're gonna do this, you're going to become a great saint, you're going to do this or that. I decree it, and therefore so. But history is noticeably bare of such of accounts of this occurring. And the reality is that one cannot reach that level, generally. I'm just going to say generally, because there's going to be some exception someone will cite to me if I don't find it myself. But that exception will prove the rule, that one can only attain to these higher levels of soul consciousness or soul being or being consciousness when, after one has participated in pursuing the Derech Hashem, the way of God, in walking the spiritual path, in seeking to cleave to and imitate God. And that's work, my friend. That's work. You have to work at it. You have to consciously be aware of your inner state. Is your inner state higher or lower than it should be? What's your average inner state? Is it a highly spiritual state, highly conscious state? Are you constantly examining your motives for their morality and their ethics? Are you aware of your actions before you do them? Or are you like an automaton, meaning that you're nothing more than like a dog, that when Pavlov rang his bells, they salivated because they were conditioned to know that the ringing of a bell was soon followed with the receipt of food. That's what I mean by automatic responses. Are you an automaton, or are you a self-willed thinking person? I'm getting a little bit far afield here, but this is all relevant to what I'm talking about. It has to do with the different levels of the soul, and it has to do with the knowing of God. God is not going to come into any container. Let's put it this way. God is not going to come into one's house if it's a pigsty. All right? Similarly, God is not going to come into your house if you are a murderer, if you are a bloodthirsty killer, if you are a serial killer, if you have killed someone in order to get their will, which you got changed at the last moment or that you forged. God is not going to come into your house if you are constantly engaged in sexual acts or fantasies that are depraved. God is not going to come into your house if it's corrupted and filthy because you have failed to do your best to follow God's commandments, as he set down for us in the Decalogue. These would be the laws. And in 613 mitzvot, these would be the regulations. Does it mean God won't come into our house? And I'm talking about now with house meaning our body, meaning the temple of our being consciousness. Is God going to come in there if we have allowed all sorts of filth to accumulate there? And we are constantly thinking about dirty and filthy things. And I don't mean just sexually. I'm talking about things such as, how can I get ahead at work? Well, the only way I'm ever going to get that promotion is if I can somehow get rid of this person who is my competitor. And that person's better than me. So what can I do? I know what I'll do. I will set that person up. When that person goes to lunch, I know that person's code because I've watched that person's password. And I'm going to go over there and I'm going to use that password to get in. And then I'm going to make some changes in some critical files to which that person only, other than the supervisors, has access. And then when those changes are discovered, they will point the finger of blame at my competitor, and that person will be my competitor no longer. Don't think this goes on? Well, perhaps you're thinking, yeah, I know it goes on because I did it, or I had somebody do it to me. You bet it goes on. It goes on every single day. It's repeated thousands and thousands of times in the workplaces across the Americas and in Europe. Dog-eat-dog world, right? Get that other person before he gets me. Well, when you do that, God doesn't want to come into you. God wants all of that cleaned up. That's why God put us here in the world, is to clean all of that up, to eliminate those things, to create an environment of love and respect for each other, to realize after all of these thousands of years of war and strife and intrigue and betrayal on this planet of each other, to realize finally that when we betray an other, we are betraying ourselves. When we betray an other, we are betraying ourselves. And so we must truly do as we've been instructed to do, love our neighbor, which means any other person, as we love ourselves. Because we are that other person. That person is not that much different than we are. The same hopes, the same fears, the same temptations, the same weaknesses. The details of all of those things are inconsequential. We are all the same. We are brothers. As the Lakota say in the Lakota tongue, Metakuye Oyasi. Metakuye Oyasi. We are all related. Or, all my relations. Means all of us, we're all related. So, it truly is a true saying, a wonderful thing to think. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you, because that other person is you. Not to mention which, if you do something bad to somebody, it's going to rebound on you, either in this life or in the next. And so it's totally pointless. And God's not going to come into any person who keeps a messy house, a filthy house. No, I'm not talking about your house. You know what I'm talking about. I'm talking about your mind, your heart. Your mind and your heart have to be pure as much as you can. Does it mean you have to be 100% successful in obeying the 615 mitzvot? No, no way. It's impossible. No person has done it, and no person can do it. Anyone who tells you otherwise is doing you a great disservice, because he's sowing in your mind a setup for failure that will only make you want to quit. God only wants you to work on these things. God realizes that you're a human being. God made you in his image. You can only succeed in the things that he gave to you that are the powers that you have, the gifts that you have. You can only succeed on a human level. And God knows that he made humans weak and frail creatures. And God knows that the very first one he made, Adam and his wife, his counterpart, Hava, Eve, the first thing they did was sin. The first thing they did was fail to follow one of his rules. So God knew how it was going to be. God knows that we're not going to succeed 100% of the time. He just wants us to try. He wants us to have the right kavana, the mystical intention. He wants us to be conscious of what we're doing. He wants us to be conscious of our level of achievement or level of a failure at any given time. And he wants us to work on ourselves. That's what God wants. He wants us to work on ourselves, to work toward perfection, to work toward becoming more like God and less like animals. Animals. What is animal man? That's one of the levels that human beings go through. Animal man. It means, what is the nature of animals? The nature of animals is that they socialize and dominate. Look at a pack of wolves. There's the alpha male who became the alpha male because he was able to physically dominate all the other males. Same with a troop of chimpanzees. Same with flocks of birds. There's a hierarchy. There's a social group that is hierarchically structured based upon the exercise of power, strength, and the ability to persuade. And that's what animals are. And that's what animal man is as a description of one's spiritual state. And not all of us are in that, but a great many of us are. And that's why it is that there are so many people out here who are totally asleep, totally unconscious of the big picture, and who really only think that all there is to life is getting and spending, in the words of William Wordsworth, getting and spending. And I'm reminded that in our Purim service, when we finished last Friday, we were just having conversations and discussion with some of the people who were present in the room. And one of them asked me, I'm not so sure, what is Kabbalah? What is that about? And I said, well, in a few short words, as few as I can make them, Kabbalah exists and has set for itself the purpose of answering some of these following questions. Who am I? How did I get here? Why do I exist? Do I have a purpose? What is the purpose and the meaning of life? Who is God? Where is God? How do I establish a meaningful relationship with God? I said, these are truly the only questions worth seeking answers for in life. Generally, what is the meaning? They fall under the category, what is the meaning of life? Okay? And when I said that, one of the persons there typed in as a response, nope, not interested. And bang, they checked out of the Pal Talk room, and I just had to laugh, because that's like saying, how can a person not be interested in answering those questions? Well, the reason they're not interested is because they're still on the level of animal man. They still think that there's nothing more to life than getting and spending, having relationships with others in which you use them, you use others for what you can get out of them, and then you discard them. And you're always looking over your back to make sure that over your shoulder, behind your back, to make sure somebody's not sneaking up on you to get your stash, your whatever you've accumulated in life. And life is a dog-eat-dog world. Well, that's evidently the position that person was in. That person is not yet has not acquired what Gurdjieff called a magnetic center. Magnetic center. That is, he has not built up in himself enough experience to come to that point in his psychic evolution to realize there is God and we are human beings that came from God. Why did God put us here? That person's just not there yet. We all, at one point or another, were in that person's shoes. But gradually, over many lifetimes, we evolve upward, out of that level, to a higher level. And that's the level where we start trying to answer those questions. That's called embarking upon the spiritual path. I've eaten up most of this time period in discussing this. Evidently, it was important, and it is all related. It's all the time we've got for today, but Wednesday we will carry on in this vein and teach what God gives us to teach and learn what God gives us to learn. In the meantime, this has been recorded as an MP3 file. It will be put up on our website later this evening. And if you want, though, you can come back and hear the rebroadcast of it in the same room, which will occur at 7 p.m. 10 p.m. Eastern Time, 7 p.m. Pacific. Our next live class will be on Wednesday at the same time as today, 7 p.m. Eastern, 4 p.m. Pacific. Between now and then, I ask that God's blessing be upon you, and I hope that you will remember God at least twice a day, and that you will go from strength to strength. Be well. Sei gesund.